in half?
Yes.
So 7.5 minutes for each?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And then after that, appellants, you will have 15 minutes for your rebuttal arguments. The podium in the middle, you can lower and raise it, and you can also adjust the microphone so that we can hear you clearly. This will be taped, it'll be audio taped, and then it'll also be live streamed. There is also a clock there to indicate to you how much time you have left, so please be careful of that, so you know how much time you have remaining. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jacob Siegel of the Cerisi Conlin firm. I represent Tina Lund as conservator of the Honorable Fred Karasoff. Judge Karasoff's daughter, Danny, is with us in the courtroom this morning as well. Judge Karasoff suffered a sudden cardiac arrest while exercising at an Orange Theory fitness studio in Minneapolis. The studio had access to the piece of equipment that would have prevented his catastrophic anoxic brain injury, an automated external defibrillator, or AED. Yet Orange Theory's coach failed to use it. Judge Karasoff was a dedicated member of the Hennepin County bench and a former military lawyer and prosecutor. He dedicated his career to the rule of law and to ensuring that every litigant received a fair trial. In this case, the misconduct of opposing counsel and, respectfully, certain decisions of the trial court deprived Judge Karasoff of that fair trial that he, like all other litigants, deserved. For three reasons, the decisions of the trial court should be reversed and the matter remanded for a new trial. First, opposing counsel deliberately misled the jury as to the legal standard that applied to the sole claim that was tried, and the trial court failed to take adequate action to correct the misapprehension in the jurors' minds.
Second, counsel.
Yes, sir.
Didn't the court instruct the jury that the court was going to instruct on the law and to ignore other discussions about the law from the lawyers?
Yes, Your Honor. There was a generic instruction along those lines that was given at the beginning of the second day of trial and at the time the court instructed the jury. But under these circumstances, we don't believe that was enough, and that's for the following reasons. As the court is aware, the sole claim in this case was for willful and wanton negligence. Willful and wanton negligence is the defendant discovering the plaintiff in a position of peril and failing to exercise ordinary care. Now, that is, as the Supreme Court has said directly, a misnomer. It is inherently confusing. It is inherently confusing to lawyers, and it is certainly inherently confusing to a lay jury. So in the opening argument, when defense counsel for Calhoun Orange, introduced that standard by saying, by the way, this is not a negligence claim. The claim in this case is willful and wanton negligence, which is a much higher burden on the plaintiff. That was a misstatement of the law.
How is that a misstatement of law? Didn't the parties agree on the jury instructions?
So it is a misstatement of the law, Your Honor. The parties... the parties ultimately agreed on a jury instruction.
Okay, and that jury instruction says that in this case, the plaintiff has alleged a claim of greater than ordinary negligence called willful and wanton negligence. And then the last sentence says, in these circumstances, ordinary negligence rises to a higher level, that of willful and wanton negligence. So how is that statement a misstatement of the law?
Right. There are two elements in which it's a misstatement of the law. First of all, the assertion that it's a much higher burden. It is a higher burden in the sense that there's an additional element. The element is that the defendant encountered the plaintiff in a position of peril. And it is that fact, that situation, that makes ordinary negligence rise to a particular level of greater than ordinary negligence. But it is not a level that has to do with the... dictionary definition or the lay jury's understanding of what the terms willful and wanton mean. So in this case, not only was there the misstatement that it was a much higher burden, but there was the injection of these terms, willful and wanton, which in the law, in this context, means something very different than they often mean in the law, and certainly means something very different than they mean to a lay juror. Now, when that statement was made in opening, appellant's counsel immediately objected and asked the jury to cure the misstatement by giving an instruction as to what the legal definition of willful and wanton negligence was. And the court declined to give that instruction, instead giving the generic instruction that Judge Cleary mentioned. But it wasn't only that, Your Honors. It was piling on. In closing,
counsel, yes, Your Honor. The court sustained the objection, correct?
The court sustained the objection, yes.
Okay.
But at closing, so contrast that with what happened at closing argument. At closing argument, counsel not only brought up the terms willful and wanton negligence, but he specifically appealed, and this was after having agreed to the jury instruction that Judge Reyes was referring to, the jury instruction that makes it clear what the standard is. He specifically appealed to those dictionary definitions. He said, intentional, deliberate, indifference, don't care. And at that point, counsel for appellant objected, and that objection was not ruled on by the court. And in addition to that, the court did not give a specific curative instruction. The court only gave the kind of instruction, Judge Cleary, that you mentioned, which is given in almost every case, if not every case.
And that instruction was given at the end again, right, that you have the jury has to follow the court's instructions on the law.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. It was. And in many cases, that probably would have been enough. But this is a very unique case. This is a case in which there is an inherently confusing standard to apply, and in which defense counsel repeatedly returned to this topic as a deliberate trial strategy of confusing the jury about the legal standard that was to apply.
Counsel, I'd be about halfway through your time. Do you want to address the exculpatory clause?
Yes, Your Honor. I can move on to that. And we do realize that, of course, before I move to that, that there is an abuse of discretion standard that applies to the first issue. At the same time, where it's so fundamental and where it pertains to the fundamental issue on which the jury is to render its opinion, we believe that this rises to the level of abuse of discretion and the court has some responsibility to police that line between zealous advocacy and simply misleading the jury. Now, on the second issue, the issue of the exculpatory clause, even if the court is not inclined to grant a new trial on the willful and wanton negligence issue, we are entitled to try the remaining claims for negligence that were raised. Now, the trial court, in enforcing the exculpatory clause, contravened binding Minnesota Supreme Court precedent. And I think it's important to pause on how we got here. So this was decided on summary judgment. Of course, the court standard of review is de novo. But also consider that at the trial court, Calhoun Orange's only argument on summary judgment was that a certain sentence, what they call the first sentence, in the client intake agreement, which was a broad exculpatory clause, and there was a similar sentence in the membership agreement of which they were never able to produce a signed copy, that it was broad enough that it generically covered a claim for Calhoun Orange's own negligence. Now, that argument is now unsupportable after the Supreme Court's decision in Justice versus Marvel, as they effectively acknowledge. So now they came back and said, well, keep reading. The next sentence does explicitly mention negligence, which it does. But the mere fact that this is not a sentence that their own counsel saw fit to even cite to in the briefing below.
But isn't that because of the fact that the decision by the Supreme Court in Marvel came out in the interim period from the summary judgment to our subsequent arguments?
So, yes, Your Honor, it is okay. The...
Well, so it did change the landscape for everybody, right?
I don't... It was certainly a new decision that is factually accurate. I don't believe that it did fundamentally change the landscape. It was already the case, and this has been the law dating back to solidification, that exculpatory clauses are strictly construed.
True. That's a general statement of law, but what the Supreme Court in the Marvel case did is specifically said that this particular language in the exculpatory clause in the Marble case is not enough.
That
is certainly something that is different, because a lot of entities have used that type of language before.
Some entities have certainly used that language.
And I think your argument is that that language is nearly identical to the language in the first sentence in that clause, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that is one of our arguments.
So, and you know, on page 28 of your brief, you compare the exculpatory clause language in Calhoun Orange's clause to the Justice case exculpatory clause. And when I look at the two, I'm not sure if they're actually identical. I will say, just speaking for myself, I think that first sentence is not specific enough. But the second sentence seems to be very similar to the justice exculpatory language in terms of saying, we hereby release and hold harmless Marble from and against any and all claims, injuries, liabilities, or damages arising out of or related to the use of the play area and or inflatable equipment. And you argue that Marble stands for the proposition that that is not enough because it doesn't mention negligence at all, and it doesn't mention releasing the party from their own acts or omissions, right?
Yes, Your Honor. That is one of our arguments.
Okay, so when I look at the second sentence, it says, client hereby agrees to indemnify, defend, hold harmless, release, and discharge the studio and facility from all claims, demands, injuries, damages, actions, causes of action, and from all acts of active or passive negligence on the part of the studio. So that clause seems to fill in the missing blanks for the Marble exculpatory clause. Am I missing something there?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason is because...
So it does fill in the missing blanks then?
No, I don't think that it fills in the
missing
blanks.
Okay, I thought you were agreeing with me. Okay.
So let me explain. So in Marvel versus Justice, there was not only the holding that that one particular clause was invalid. The court also instructed how we are to interpret exculpatory clauses, the circumstances under which they can be valid. And we're not in ordinary contractual interpretation land. This is not a fair construction exercise. This is a strict construction exercise, and it is a particularly strict construction exercise, because there doesn't even need to be any ambiguity in the sentence for it to be unenforceable. The standard here is that clause, is that second sentence clear and unequivocal?
So where is it not clear and unequivocal? I don't see any ambiguity. It seems pretty clear to me.
Well, that's exactly it, Your Honor. There doesn't need to be ambiguity. It doesn't need to be the case that.
What is it? What does it need then? What is it missing?
It's word salad. It begins by making this reference to indemnification, not exculpation. It's missing words, Your Honor. It's missing punctuation, and most critically, it has that vague limiting term at the end, which we referred to in our brief.
Well, it's not just indemnification. And in fact, if you want to look at indemnification, if you look at the Scholholm case, which is cited in Marble, the language seems to be very, very similar to that. And Marble distinguished Scholholm and said that that was enough. And in Scholholm, they refer to, quote, all acts of active or passive negligence on the part of the company. And the one here says, from all acts of active or passive negligence on the part of the studio. That's nearly verbatim language.
Yes, Your Honor, but you're parsing only a part of the sentence. And the question is, if a consumer is reading that sentence as he or she is going about his or her daily life, is that sentence so clear that it conveys unequivocally, here's what you're doing?
Well, we do have to parse the language. That's the whole exercise we have to undertake here. But it's not just that clause. It's not that phrase. It's also, I'm looking at the whole sentence, and I purposely read the whole first phrase of it because it goes to client hereby agrees to hold harmless, release, and discharge the studio, et cetera, from all acts of active or passive negligence on the part of the studio. I mean, it's more than just an indemnification clause. It's also a hold harmless and release clause.
So, Your Honor, it is. You have to also consider that it's in the contract after a very clear clause that pertains only to exculpation. But I think our main point...
But that's this next sentence in that very same clause.
Well, I think our main point, Your Honor, is there's that clause at the end, which we haven't talked about yet, which is the vague limiting term arising from or in connection with the activities that client voluntarily participates. By the way, there's no in. It's missing a word there as well. And that is a vague term. I mean, in our brief, we give some examples of activities that may or may not be activities that the client voluntarily participates
in. Counsel, you're almost out of time, and I was hoping that you'd be able to talk to us about retroactivity. Presuming we find that defective, what about retroactivity under justice?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the general rule in the Supreme Court has made clear the general rule is that decisions are retroactive unless there's a specific pronouncement or special circumstances exist. In terms of a specific pronouncement, they say that this case is because the court said we now hold, which is language that's used in, I don't know, virtually every appellate decision, but many appellate decisions, that's analogous to the instruction henceforth that a particular jury instruction should be given, and we just don't believe that that's the case. But I see that my time has expired, so I will take my seat.
And counsel, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondents, who will be going first then?
I will, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Julia Nierengarten. I'm here on behalf of respondent Calhoun Orange, doing business as Orange Theory Fitness, Minneapolis Uptown. My plan today is to speak to you about two issues, the exculpatory clause and the misconduct allegation against counsel. I'm going to start with the exculpatory clause since that's where we left off. Justice tells us that exculpatory clauses are subject to strict construction, and to withstand strict construction, the exculpatory clause must use specific express language that clearly and unequivocally states the contracting party's intent. Our exculpatory clause does this by using the language that Justice Court specifically cited as doing so. And I will refer the court to that language. Judge Reyes was just referring to the all acts of active and passive negligence.
Counsel, that's the indemnification clause, correct?
You're correct, Your Honor, but the justice opinion also makes the note that when you're talking about an indemnification clause that essentially makes the signing party, in this case the appellant, responsible for indemnifying the party, the studio, it essentially functions as an exculpatory clause.
Well, I'm certain that would be my argument if I were you, but I think you referenced it as part two of an exculpatory clause, but it seems to me that the whole point of the justice opinion was to say you need to put it in both parts, exculpatory clause and the indemnification clause.
Well, I guess I'm not certain that I read it exactly the same way, although I will accept that that is a reasonable interpretation of justice. But essentially, when the function of the indemnification clause is to exculpate the studio from liability for acts of active and passive negligence...
It's indemnifying the studio.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. But in doing so, it has the same effect, and that's the language that justice uses. It has the same effect as an exculpation clause, presumably because if you've signed an exculpatory clause, or a contract with an indemnification clause that says you're going to have to indemnify the other side for their own negligence, and you sue them for negligence, it's sort of a zero-sum game in terms of how it has the same effect as the exculpatory clause.
Well, we're certainly parsing words, but then the Supreme Court did the same thing.
Correct. And we have to remember that this is a contract, and as we all know from Contracts 101, you have to read the contract. You can't read one sentence, one phrase, one part of the contract in isolation. You have to read it in its context, correct?
Well, Contract 101 also suggests that when it's a release clause like this that a customer is more or less forced to sign, that there is strict construction against the business, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And I just want to, with respect to that, reading it as a whole, obviously our argument is that you have to read that section as a whole, those two sentences together, along with the other sentences that surround them. And I want to just address appellant's comment about the ambiguous language at the end of the sentence. This argument came out on reply in response to our argument about the acts of active and passive negligence. And I just want to make the point that the end of that sentence is only ambiguous if you don't read the entire section. There's no ambiguity in the clause because that clause comes at item number 4 on a list of 4 items, and that list begins with the introductory phrase. With the introductory phrase, I, the client, voluntarily desire to participate in physical exercise training classes conducted on behalf of Orange Theory Fitness Uptown. So when we're talking about the activities that the client voluntarily participates in, when it's part of that list that starts out with that explanation, I voluntarily desire to participate in physical exercise training classes, when they're talking within all of the items in there, they refer back to this similar language, the exercise classes, voluntary participation. That's the activity we're talking about.
Counsel, what do we do with the fact of appellant's argument that second sentence wasn't raised to the district court?
Well, it is a de novo review, and as Judge Reyes pointed out, the landscape changed between when we argued the summary judgment motion to the district court and when we, are now before this court. There are a couple of points on that. This court can affirm summary judgment on any basis in the record. Obviously, this whole exculpatory, all of the whole contract, the whole client intake form is part of the record. The court's job is to review the judicial acts, which in this case was granting summary judgment, not necessarily the court's reason for doing so. So even if this court disagrees with the district court's reasoning, it can still affirm the summary judgment because that was the correct outcome based on the language in the intake form. I only have about a minute and a half left. I just want to really briefly address the alleged misconduct issue for your honors. So there's this allegation. This was the basis of their post-trial motion, seeking a new trial on the basis of alleged attorney misconduct by defense counsel. The district court, the standard of review, of course, is abuse of discretion because the district court who sat through trial is in the best position to determine whether any alleged misconduct was misconduct, and then also whether it was prejudicial to the moving party. Appellant identifies 2 remarks from counsel over the course of a 5-day trial. Most of what they cite to as, showing that this was prejudicial or misconduct in some way happens away from the hearing of the jury. I mean, it's conversations between the court. I want to point out how thorough the district court judge was in discussing this issue with the parties, discussed it with them at the end of the first day, discussed it with them again at the beginning of the second day. She exercised her judgment to do what district court judges do all the time and sort of, play with the cards that she's dealt. She determined that it was appropriate at the beginning of trial to provide that sort of generic instruction about who defines the law. And ultimately, at the end of trial, appellant got the instruction that she wanted on willful and wanton negligence. The jury was again instructed at the end of trial about who defines the law. And not to be too flippant about it, but simply not prevailing at trial doesn't mean that some remark made by opposing counsel that may or may not have been misconduct was prejudicial. I see my time is up. If your honors have any more questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I need to step aside for my co-counsel.
Thank you, counsel.
Very much.
Thank you. Good morning, your honors. Theodore Waldeck on behalf of Ultimate Fitness. It's an honor to be here. We didn't really get to, or appellant did not yet get to, any of the issues regarding the vicarious liability claims against my client. I would say this from the outset, that if a new trial is not granted, there would be no reason whatsoever to permit a case to proceed against my client, and for the simple reason that the claims against my client are ones for vicarious liability. Originally, my client was not a part of the lawsuit. There was a motion to amend. That amendment was to just two counts in the complaint, one of which it was count two, the willful and wanton count. The other one was the deceptive trade practices count, count five, which was later voluntarily dismissed and is not at issue today. Frankly, the briefing on those issues, I think, is fairly straightforward. I'll switch gears for one moment in talking about vicarious liability to address this argument of apparent authority that was raised at the summary judgment stage with my client and is now also at issue in this appeal. I'm happy to address any questions on it, but there's just a fundamental difference in appellant's interpretation of reliance versus my client's interpretation of reliance. It's outlined in the brief, the Popovich case being kind of the seminal case that both parties refer to as this provides the roadmap for how to analyze this issue. What they're saying, and where the disagreement exists, is they're saying knowledge equals reliance, and what we're saying is reliance equals reliance. I think that to the extent there's any confusion on that issue, there are opinions that would, of course, exist where if there's no knowledge, it answers the question of reliance. There cannot be reliance if there's no knowledge in the first place. So you don't need to say, did somebody rely on something they didn't know about? But the appellant is trying to state that that is the standard. It's clear throughout any of the cases that you looked at that are cited in the briefs that there needs to be some form of actual reliance. Now, in this case, there is no evidence of any reliance whatsoever. If there were any evidence, if there was an iota of evidence that there was some reliance by Fred Karasoff, that my client, that he had selected this particular Orange Theory because he believed it to be connected to Ultimate Fitness and that was important for him, we'd be talking about that. That would be the central issue of this argument. We're only talking about whether his presumed knowledge, which is really inferred in this case, but we don't need to get into that, of there being a connection between the two was enough to establish reliance. Of course, that can't be the case. I would say that would be evidence that there, in fact, was never any reliance. That is our position on the issue of apparent authority. There are also,
but doesn't reliance have an aspect of knowledge to it?
I think so.
You can't have reliance unless you have some type of knowledge.
Yes, correct. I agree with that absolutely, and I think that that's why there are cases where, again, if there's never any knowledge in the first place, a court may not then get into an analysis of whether or not they relied on it. That would be unnecessary. The lack of knowledge answers the reliance question. I don't think that's the same thing as saying knowledge equals reliance, though. That's taking an additional step and saying you don't actually need reliance, you just need to have knowledge of the relationship, and that there's no case that's saying that.
Isn't that a reasonable inference that you can make, though, that if you have knowledge of it, that you can rely on it?
No, I don't think so. And here I'll use this specific case as an example, which is why did Fred Karasoff go to this particular Orange Theory? In my experience, and this obviously isn't in the record, people would select places that are close to where they live. A lot of people, when it comes to fitness studios, will follow a trainer that has maybe moved to that specific place. They may know other people that go there. Those would be the standard reasons to go there. I don't frankly think, and again, I'm being argumentative here, that people are selecting these places because of who the franchisor is in this scenario. This particular Orange Theory would have been very close to where Mr. Karasoff was living at the time in and around the uptown area. That's probably why we don't know. But that's exactly my point, is we don't know why he selected it, and there is no evidence that he relied upon a relationship in his selection of that Orange Theory. And that's the important distinction. So if you agree with them that all you need is knowledge, then there's probably a fact question in there as to whether or not somebody could have inferred that there was some knowledge of a relationship there. But if you agree with the position that I've taken, that I believe the Supreme Court and other courts have made clear, that's not enough. You have to have some evidence that the individual actually relied on it.
Couldn't the reliance, the evidence of reliance, be that he signed the contract? Wouldn't that be a step beyond knowledge, that he signed this intake form and agreed to go to this specific place?
I don't think so, but I don't, maybe I'm not understanding your question. I mean, I think that goes to, it could go to knowledge, I think. It might create a fact issue of if you look at this and you see an Orange Theory trademark or mark on it, somebody could look into that and determine, okay, this is a franchise agreement and there's somebody here. I mean, my thought would be by the time you're in there signing the form, you've decided this is the one I'm going to go to anyway.
I see your point of reliance equals reliance, and reliance alone is not knowledge, or knowledge alone is not reliance. But what your point is, there's like some extra something has to happen on the reliance side. And my question is, the signing of the form, would that be enough on the reliance side?
No, I wouldn't say so, because again, it doesn't provide any evidence that the individual was actually. I'm looking for the language here, but it where do I have this? Only those who have acted in reliance on the relationship can recover. So was he signing the form because he was acting upon some type of reliance that there was a relationship between Orange Theory and Ultimate Fitness? We don't know. We just know that he signed the form, so I would say that is not enough. Am I addressing the question?
Yeah.
Okay. I have 15 seconds left. I really don't actually have anything further. If there are any questions, I'm happy to address them. I should say this. With regard to the exculpatory clause, I cited the Starlight Limited case on page 22 of my brief that says a fundamental purpose of contract law is to protect the reasonable expectations of the parties who enter into a bargain. We have a document which is clear and unambiguous. The Schoenblum case has stated that language is clear and unambiguous, that was signed by Judge Karasoff.
I'm sorry, do we have a signed copy?
It's in the record, yes, Your Honor.
I understood that there wasn't a copy produced that he had signed.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's the client intake form is what I'm referring to that has the...
Versus the membership agreement.
Correct.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
So I will focus on Mr. Waldeck's comments regarding apparent authority. Now, Mr. Waldeck stood up here and said there needs to be some form of actual reliance. In a tort case, actual reliance is not required. That is specifically held in the Popovich case on page 895. It says, our precedent does not describe an actual reliance standard. So we believe in a tort case, knowledge alone is sufficient, and knowledge can be inferred from the circumstances here. But even if there is some additional element, some delta that needs to be shown, Mr. Waldeck did not describe what that delta is. The trial court did not describe what that element is either.
The case law uses both terms, though, right? It uses knowledge and reliance.
It does use both terms, Your Honor, and particularly in contract cases. But I think if you look exclusively at the tort cases that are cited in the briefs, yes, it does use the term reliance, but there's also the description in Popovich of what reliance is. And it refers to, generally the principle in tort law is, if you are holding another entity out in a way that the members of the public have this apprehension in their mind that it is your agent, it is incumbent on you to correct that misapprehension that may exist in their minds. And so cases like the Duluth Herald case, like the Lindstrom versus Minnesota Liquid Fertilizer case, those cases show there are actions that you can take to make sure that people are aware that this company, you know, maybe your franchise, is not you. And none of those actions were taken here. What does the record show? The record says that all that was done was putting a placard, a small placard, saying this studio is independently owned and operated, in an area internal to the studio in which people did not normally, in which members did not normally have access.
Well, let me ask you about that, because, so let's say in this hypothetical, you have a sign outside the elevator that says this was last maintained October 11th, 2023. Now, I have knowledge of when it was last maintained, but wouldn't the reliance be to actually go into the elevator and use it?
So perhaps in some contexts, Your Honor, but in this context, that's simply not the standard that's being described, right? You can consider in the Popovich case, the idea that the hospital put forth was that you would have to be able to show that but for the fact that they had made these representations that the emergency doctors were their people, these good doctors that were part of their system, you would not have sought care there. And the court clearly said that is not the standard. Now, it defined a particular standard that is unique to the circumstances of a hospital in which it's both a healthcare entity and it is a location where people go to get healthcare from other providers. But that's simply not analogous to what the situation is here. And so, you know, we don't believe that there's any need to show that, you know, but for the fact that they were Orange Theory, that they answered the phone as Orange Theory, that they have Orange Theory branding and only Orange Theory branding all over their studio, that their staff wear Orange Theory garments, that their website refers to this as just the Orange Theory Uptown location, that Judge Karasoff would not have joined the gym. We don't believe that that would be an actual reliance, a but-for reliance standard. And that is not the standard under our law. As time is short, I will just say, I would refer to our brief on the issue of respondeat superior, because frankly, I think that issues of fact abound here. The franchise agreement says not only can they make and enforce system standards, but those can refer to any aspect of the operation and maintenance of the studio. And that is an extraordinarily broad grant of authority. That's not merely brand standardization or protecting their marks. I just want to mention one thing from the briefs. I would encourage the court to read the deposition of Paul Reuter, who was the 30.02F rep for the franchisor. On page 12, it is inadvertently cited to the wrong doc ID. It's doc 73 at Exhibit B. I just wanted to make sure the court was aware of that. I see my time has expired. Unless there are any questions, we would just respectfully ask the court to reverse the decisions of the district court and remand for a new trial on all claims against both respondents. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel, for all parties. It was very well briefed and very well argued. I'm sure your clients appreciate the very good representation that you provided them. We'll be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you all.